A remarkable number of Christmas songs, Christmas carols, Christmas hymns have a wistful, melancholic, plain old sad side to them. Think about the little drummer boy and In the Bleak Midwinter, both of which are sung in the voice of one who knows poverty. I am a poor boy too, pa-rum pa-rum pum. What shall I give him, poor as I am? Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Sings about finitude and randomness. Through the years we all will be together, if the fates allow. And it sings as well of troubles, which the one singing it now hopes, longs. There's this aching and beautiful longing that the troubles will now be miles away. And even we need a little Christmas, as toe-tapping and danceable a Christmas number as there is. We need a little Christmas right this very minute. It's almost impossible not to sing that song in your Angela Lansbury voice, although maybe that was more of an Ethel Merman voice than Angela, I'm not sure. And yet, even this song tells us we've grown a little leaner, grown a little colder, grown a little sadder, grown a little older. What's going on that so many Christmas songs, the book for so many Christmas songs, are stained with tears? Well, part of it is, I think, just the time of year. This really is the bleak midwinter. The days are criminally short. We have this diagnosis someone made up a while ago called seasonal affective disorder, but I think that's actually just called being human near the solstice. This is just, it's so easy to be out of gas at this time of year when the sun is setting before 5 p.m. Some of it has to do with the vibe of the holiday season. If you are not feeling entirely happy, if you're feeling a little sad or quite sad at a time when happiness is expected or even mandatory, there's a dissonance in that. There is a dissonance if Christmas is a time where you're sitting with grief or loss or some other kind of disorientation, and it appears that all around you is merriment and friends and Facebook updates and Christmas cards that are laden with success and winning and winning. It's hard to be like that. And some of it, I think, is just about having time off. I don't know about you, but if you're like me and your preferred drug is not so much booze as it is busyness, just having time off gives you the opportunity to be sad. And some of it is built right into Christmas itself, not the feast we keep now, but the story itself of the birth of Jesus. Sorrow is woven right in with the joy in this story. Here's a family that is living in poverty. Remember in the Gospel of Luke that when the family brings the baby Jesus to the temple to make a sacrifice of thanksgiving, that what they purchase to sacrifice is a pair of turtle doves and a pair of pigeons, the cheapest possible animals that they can buy. This is a clue that their wallets are very nearly empty. Here is a family that is living with the indignity and fear of occupation. Mary must give birth on the road because that is what empire demands of them. And here is a family after Jesus' birth who are forced to flee their country, who become refugees going to Egypt. And they flee because empire's violence is now turned upon them. This sorrow woven into joy is not just in the story, but those of you who've been hanging around at church for a while will know it's actually woven into the Christmas season as well. 3 days after the feast that is Christmas Day, 3 days after the 25th, a feast that fewer of us come to church for is kept on the 28th, and that is the Feast of the Holy Innocents, the day on which we remember the children under the age of 2 whom Herod has murdered in the hopes that the Christ child will be among them. And these, the story of these murders, starting in the 20th century, what we would call this crime against humanity, is a story that we probably ought to tell today as well. Except due to one of those curious choices that the folks who put the lectionary together made. So the lectionary is the schedule of readings that we follow from one Sunday to the next. We just omit in the reading that I just did, the reading you just heard, we just omit the part where Herod murders the children. So we have Joseph being warned in a dream to flee. We have Joseph fleeing. And then, guess what? Herod is dead, and they lived happily ever after. It's almost a plot of a Disney film. Except there's these three verses that we just hop over. When Herod saw that he'd been tricked by the wise men, he was infuriated, and he sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had learned from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled, because they are no more. In creches and Christmas cards and a lot of art, the Magi are these jovial, kind, harmless figures marching along with their camels and their boxes freshly gift-wrapped at Macy's or maybe by Amazon. But in the actual story, in the story as we encounter it, they are, in addition to happy figures, tragic figures. They are figures who have chosen to trust. They have chosen to trust the king. You ought to be able to trust the king. And they have chosen to trust Herod with the best possible news. The Messiah is born. And Herod betrays. He violates their trust. And as a consequence, they become these tragic people who accidentally invite this violence into Jesus' life, into Mary and Joseph's life, into the young lives of we don't know how many innocent and unnamed children. They're children who will now never get to grow up. So I have some distressing news to share with you this morning. Over the last couple of months, have likely received an email from Grace warning you about an email scam that's been going on. So someone has been variously pretending to be me, pretending to be Jean, pretending to be parishioner and asking for monetary help. I'm really sorry to let you know that no fewer than 2 parishioners have been defrauded by this scheme. One parishioner was defrauded out of about $200, and another was defrauded out of $1,300. Now, I realize I've just segued from talking about the murder of children to the stealing of money. And let me stop here and emphasize I'm not drawing a moral equivalent between the two things. Please do not go home saying the preacher likened murdering children to email scams. That's not what I'm saying at all. Obviously, these are really different moral categories from one another. I think what I want to suggest to you this morning is that this scam is a microcosm. It is a very small version, a tiny version of the violence that we hear about in the gospel and the violence that we hear about today in churches and synagogues and mosques where a shooter or someone with a knife or a machete is entering into a place of worship. Because all of these acts of violence are just like what happens to the Magi. They're all of them betrayals of trust. We come to a place of worship because we trust. We trust that in this place we're going to find healing, belonging, and meaning. We trust that in this place we're going to find love and goodness. We trust that we're going to find communion in this place. We trust that we are going to be safe here. And when that trust is violated by a scammer, or still worse, by someone coming in with a weapon, it's an incredibly big violation. And it leaves us saying, what shall we do? How shall we live if someone is violating the trust that we share with one another? Should we be on guard? Is church also a place where we need to be suspicious and skeptical and always looking out of the corner of our eye? And a possible answer to that question is yes. And for some of our fellow people of faith, the answer is absolutely yes. Many of you, most of you, will have heard the news story that a shooting in a church in Texas was stopped because several of the parishioners had guns on them, and one of the churchgoers was able to shoot the perpetrator and thus prevent who knows how many murders from happening. So this is the famous good guy with a gun, except in real life. And what's the takeaway for us at Grace? Should we also be arming ourselves? Should we ask the servers and the choir to have pistols underneath their vestments? Should I keep a machine gun stowed in the pulpit? Would that be a wise precaution? And similarly, should I be distant and untrusting when I'm asked for help? Maybe the answer is yes. Maybe the streetwise answer to that question is yes. But it's not the answer that I want to give. And I don't, maybe this is presumptuous, but I don't think it's the answer that Jesus wants us to give either. Because if Jesus is telling the truth, when in Gethsemane he tells his disciple to put away his sword, if Jesus is telling the truth when he rebukes the disciples, when they want to call down violence on the people who reject them, if Jesus is telling the truth when even on the cross he forgives, then Jesus is saying you have to keep on risking trust, risking hope, risking love. As naive as it is, as reckless as it may be, the gospel calls us to keep on risking trust. God trusts the world so much, trusts humanity so much, that God comes and lays in a manger, even though God knows that empire soldiers are coming. Theologians, when they talk about the incarnation, when they talk about the kingdom, when they talk about the gospel, will sometimes say that the kingdom has an already not yet quality to it. Already not yet. Jesus is already here, the kingdom is already here, and we are waiting for Jesus, and the kingdom is not yet here. There is this paradox, sorrow and joy in the same place, completion and longing in the same place. This paradox is woven right into this time of year. It is woven right into Christmas, into this time where we sing paradoxical songs about a paradoxical season, a season of sorrow and joy, a season of already and not yet. Jesus is here among all of the pain and all of the hurt and all of the evil, and we are waiting for Jesus. And we hold both these things. We long for Jesus' presence among us, long for his coming, long for the healing that he will bring. And we long for it because things are not as they ought to be. We've grown a little leaner, grown a little colder, grown a little sadder, grown a little older. We need a little Christmas now.